This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and you're listening to the dulcet tones of Shirley Scott, the queen of the jazz organ, with Sea Jam Blues. Also with George Tucker on bass and Mac Simpkins on drums. It is Tuesday, August the 20th, and our discussion today will look toward Detroit. And it will be part of an introduction to a complex subject that we will deal with as a series because of its many component parts. The series I'm titling Detroit, The Killing of a City. Now, of course, Detroit will be the center of our discussions, and we'll get to learn about the dynamics pertinent to that specific city. But in so many ways, Detroit will be emblematic of what I think is a movement, a very concerted and coordinated movement that will spread across America in many urban centers, as we are now called, that seeks to redefine the cities in a particular way, with a particular vision. And we'll get into what that way and vision are, because it is, if you're living in New York and some of the other major cities across the nation, it's a similar situation that has occurred before, but perhaps not nearly as well coordinated. In New York City, for example, we had the phenomenon of the burnouts. Desirable parts of the city were allowed literally to fall victim to arson and landlord abandonment, but in any event, to hit rock bottom. And after that, a resurgence, much to the benefit of the landlorded class and the politically well-connected groups and to developers, to the point that the Harlem that was abandoned just a matter of two decades ago is now a Harlem that is completely out of reach to Harlemites, and it's not accidental. October the 23rd will be the big date in court, because the judge has set that date to hear arguments as to whether Detroit legally can declare bankruptcy, whether it has proven all the requirements in order to declare bankruptcy, having to do mostly with its negotiations with creditors, its negotiations with city employees and their pension funds and so forth, their benefits, its negotiations all around, and whether it has satisfied all of the requirements, even including getting permission from the state to declare bankruptcy. But there's no question that the city of Detroit has declared that it no longer can meet its obligations due to a number of very extreme circumstances, a major downturn in the economy, flight of population, loss of a tax base, and the inability, therefore, to meet its current needs. But this is a very important thing to take a look at, because we will see examples of Detroit popping up. It is going to be, in other words, a test case for this new movement that will be implemented shortly thereafter, all across America, the redesigning and redefining of, quote, urban centers, unquote. What is behind all of this? Well, it depends on who you talk to. But if you have a long view, a short view would be, well, we're going to have to do something to respond to the immediate moment. And, of course, it's a wonderful opportunity to situate the issue that way, that it is a reaction to immediate problems. But the long view is that we are beginning a whole new era, both on the social plane and on the political plane in the United States. And it is fueled by a shift, a decided shift in demographics. We've discussed on this program that this demographic shift will now situate the so-called majority population of the United States as a numerical minority. Now, what does that mean? It means that there is going to be a test. A test of what? What this country really does mean by democracy. How is democracy measured? Some people will tell you it's by the vote, the right to vote and all the other trappings, elections and so forth. We have a Congress, a bicameral Congress. We have the government essentially divided into three, the executive and judicial and the legislative, and we have the people. But really, a democracy is to be measured, if you think about it, in terms of the access, the quality of access to strategic resources by all elements of that society. And if we were to use that as a barometer of democracy in our current time, we will have major questions about, we will have a tough time posing the argument that we really do have a democracy. But we will get into these discussions as we go. What is important for us to do is to kind of focus on Detroit as a shining example of where things are. I mean, the objective situation of where things are, but also, it leads us to what is next. How are we to interpret the reality of Detroit? Is it just about a city that is sinking under the dead weight of its own obligations and mistakes? Or is it, in fact, the predictable outcome of a way of operating politically and economically and socially? And what, therefore, is to replace it? And who is doing that? We have as our good fortune today to have a great guide to the discussion to get us started. He is Dr. Thomas Sugrue. He is a David Boies Professor of History and Sociology and Director of the Penn Social Science and Policy Forum at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a specialist in 20th century American politics, urban history, civil rights, and race. He's the author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. He's also written Sweet Land of Liberty, The Forgotten Struggle for Civil Rights in the North. He also has written, you'll hear that phrase often for the next couple of sentences, The Origins of the Urban Crisis, which won the Bancroft Prize in American History and is considered one of the seminal works in understanding urban history and urban affairs. He also has written some wonderful works that I urge you to look into if you are a student of African American and just U.S. history. W.E.B. Du Bois, Race and the City, The Philadelphia Negro and Its Legacy, The New Suburban History, which he co-edited with Kevin Cruz. He also has co-edited Politics and Culture in Modern America at the University of Pennsylvania Press. He joins us. He does us a great service today, and I'm so grateful that you could join us today. Thank you so much, Professor Sugrue, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you've studied the evolution, as it were, especially in the 20th century and 21st now, of urban centers. What, in your view, is unique about the city of Detroit, given its particular circumstances today?
Well, Detroit is an extreme case of the problems that have faced many American cities over the last half century or more. It is a place that has been transformed, sometimes for good, sometimes for bad, by the arc of American politics from the New Deal on forward. It was a city that rose and fell with the American auto industry, and it's a city that embodies the intense racial polarization, but particularly between whites and African Americans, that has really had pernicious consequences north and south in major cities and suburbs and elsewhere. It's an intensely polarized place, and the combination of public policy, private investment, and the reshaping of industrial capitalism and racial conflict has really made Detroit the place that we know today, the place that's perched on the brink of fiscal collapse.
That's you as a political scientist. How do you think, let's say, in the world of politics or the world generally, how do you think they see the dilemma of Detroit today? Do they see it as widely as you do, or do they see it considerably narrower?
Oh, well, the conventional wisdom on Detroit, and it's there in the mainstream media, and particularly on the political right, is that Detroit has been driven to bankruptcy by a combination of black misrule, that is, you know, a series of African-American mayors who didn't have the capacity to run the city effectively, by corruption, by grasping, greedy public employees unions who wanted well-paying jobs and good benefits, even if that drove the city's finances into the tank, and by, you know, a Democratic Party that aided and abetted all of this. I mean, one of the sayings that you hear, you know, that I've seen in the Twitter sphere coming from the right is, you know, Obama said, you know, Trayvon Martin could have been my son. He should say Detroit was my city. You know, in other words, that somehow the Democrats and Obama are responsible for the city's collapse. It's a gross misreading of the history of Detroit and of urban America generally, but it's one that's so commonplace that, you know, I have to spend a lot of my time taking people back to the basics and beginning where Detroit's problems really began, which was not in, you know, with the urban riot of 1967 or with the rise of black mayors or with corruption, which Detroit certainly has a history of, but really, you know, its problems are a lot more deeply rooted and longer in coming.
Well, suppose you do just that. You start us off with the basics as you see it.
Well, to understand Detroit, you know, we have to go back in some ways to the middle of the 20th century when it was a boom town. I mean, think of, you know, Las Vegas in the 1990s or the 2000s, a place that was a magnet for people coming from all over the country. Detroit attracted immigrants from Central and Eastern Europe. It attracted African Americans and Appalachian whites coming from the South, all to work in the seemingly insatiable auto industry. Jobs galore. And not only that, but by the 1940s, unionized jobs with good benefits, with security, and with a wage that would allow, you know, assembly line workers and skilled tradespeople to become middle class. So Detroit grew exponentially. It was a minor city in 1900. It was America's fourth largest city at its peak in the middle of the 20th century, and it had nearly 2 million people. In 1950, according to the census, there were 1.85 million people in Detroit. By the early 50s, it was probably even more. So what we see, in other words, is a city that explodes with population and is the embodiment of job opportunity. And, you know, Detroit's riding on the auto industry, which in the middle of the 20th century doesn't have any global competition, is benefiting from the massive economic growth in the middle of the 20th century, and you know, everyone wants a car, and car ownership is skyrocketing. But what happens beginning in the 1950s is that auto industry, in search of cheap labor, in search of lower regulations, in search of more favorable tax rates, begins to pick up and move. It's moving to outlying areas outside of Detroit. It's moving to rural areas in the upper Midwest. It's moving to the south, to the Sun Belt, where local governments and state governments are providing all sorts of incentives for companies to pick up from the Midwest and move there. And Detroit begins to hemorrhage jobs. That job loss doesn't happen like conventional wisdom would have it, just you know, in the 1970s and 1980s. It happens in the 50s when the city is still and the country is still seemingly going through an unprecedented boom. So between 1948 and 1967, Detroit loses about 140,000 manufacturing jobs, a huge number of jobs. And between 1950 and 1970, Detroit loses several hundred thousand residents, many of them picking up and going to the suburbs. And so what you have, in other words, is a city that already by the 50s is losing the two key ingredients that give it a tax base that allow it to provide good public services to its residents, that is tax-paying businesses and property taxes from residents and from companies that are there. They're leaving, and the city's tax base and its ability to provide services already begins to suffer. So this is a long history. It's not one that, you know, begins with 1967 or with the 1970s and 1980s, or even with international competition in the auto industry, the rise of the Japanese and German automakers. It begins during the boom years. And so to understand Detroit requires looking at that moment and seeing the beginning there.
Why is it that we don't see it that way?
Well, one of my friends, the great sociologist Herbert Gans, coined a phrase that he calls sociological amnesia. In a way, we Americans suffer from real amnesia when it comes to looking at our recent past and our longer history. You know, a lot of that history has just been kind of wiped clean. It's not taught in classrooms. It's not part of textbooks. Probably most importantly, it rubs against this kind of conventional wisdom that has become commonplace, that, you know, when it comes to cities, that the problems of the cities are the result of the 60s. They're the result of the tumult of the period. That conventional wisdom, which is in its own way a symptom of this amnesia, is so deeply rooted that every story that I read in the major news media, you know, pretty much says Detroit's problems begin in July of 1967, the summer that the city burned in one of the most serious riots in the 20th century. Well, Detroit had a really serious riot, one of the most serious riots in the 20th century, in 1943. You know, Detroit was a place that was riven with racial conflict well before what happened in the summer of 1967, and its problems are really deeply rooted. One of the biggest problems that Detroit faces, as many big cities in the United States do, is really intense racial segregation in housing. And again, conventional wisdom, birds of a feather flock together. Individuals choose houses and neighborhoods with people like themselves. The housing market's a manifestation of individual freedom and choice. No. Beginning in the 1930s and 1940s, federal housing policies made it very, very difficult, almost impossible, for minorities, for African Americans especially, to get federally backed mortgages to buy their own homes. They couldn't get mortgages to buy homes in all white neighborhoods or in the suburbs. So already you have a deep-rooted pattern made possible by public policy in place. It's very difficult for blacks to move anywhere in the metropolitan area other than already established black neighborhoods. At the same time, in Detroit, and lots of other cities too, as we found out by, you know, work by other historians, there's a long history of racial violence targeting blacks moving into white neighborhoods. I found just between the mid-40s and the mid-60s in my own research that there were more than 200 incidents of angry whites committing acts of vandalism, window breaking, destruction of property of the first or second black families to move into formerly white neighborhoods. And the combination of those years of violent attacks, send a signal. Stay in your place. Don't cross that invisible line of race. Don't move into predominantly white neighborhoods. If you do, you're going to pay a price. And many African Americans began to say, why would I want to live in a predominantly white neighborhood if I'm going to have all my windows broken, or if a neighbor's going to pour salt on my grass and kill it all off, or someone's going to go into my kitchen and bathrooms and basement and plug up all the sinks, turn on all the water, and flood the house, all of which happened in this period in Detroit between the mid-1940s and the mid-1960s. So what you have, in other words, is a city with a long and deep history of racial animosity, much of it targeted toward the city's growing black population. And that is poisonous and has really long-term effects on the city.
Well, this is an interesting thing because, in a way, Detroit and Chicago, I would say, began to be, in modern times, if you will, the 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, began to be an oasis or a magnet for mass movements of African Americans and others to what is now, they would now call major urban centers. But then you point to the fact that with all the folks coming, presumably to participate in this democratic setting, because the jobs are available, certainly everybody should benefit from this great resource called employment, and you would think that is in fact reflective of a democracy. But then the racial stratification began to occur, aided and abetted by governmental policy. Did somebody not see, especially when these incidents began to happen, that there was a connection between policy and the fact that the city was headed down a really dangerous path in this maintenance of strict segregation?
Yeah, well, there were people who saw it, and they began, especially during and after World War II, to organize into what would become a pretty interesting civil rights struggle in Detroit and elsewhere. Again, we think about the history of civil rights as a Southern story. It's Martin Luther King Jr. and Montgomery, Alabama, and Birmingham, Alabama, and the Freedom Riders and the sit-ins, all of which are an important part of the story. But Detroit has a civil rights movement, as do pretty much every major and even many minor, small northern cities that goes back well into the 20th century. And so beginning in the 40s, activists in Detroit and St. Louis and Chicago began to challenge housing segregation. They began to call for what they argued was open housing, that is, the freedom of blacks to move where they wanted, and began to agitate for changes in public policy to make that possible. It was really hard. It was an uphill battle. It wasn't politically popular. White elected officials didn't really have it in their interest to alienate their white constituents by supporting laws that forbade housing discrimination. Real estate brokers were really hard to modify. The federal government was really reluctant to step in, and it wasn't until the 1960s that years of civil rights pressure led to the passage of federal legislation in 1968 that forbade discrimination housing. Before 1968, it was perfectly legally permissible in much of America, including many northern cities and states, for landlords to discriminate against renters on the basis of their race, for real estate brokers to discriminate against potential buyers on the basis of race. You would see in ads, real estate ads, in Detroit and other cities up through the 1950s, things like a restricted neighborhood, referring to the fact that it was, the neighborhood was open to whites only. Or you would see, rental colored only or white only. That kind of, persistent discrimination proved very, very difficult to challenge. And even after the civil rights legislation of the 60s was passed, real estate brokers found other ways to skirt the law. The most common one, and this is well documented for Detroit as well as other big cities, was what's called steering, which is essentially real estate brokers showing houses in white neighborhoods to whites and houses in racially mixed or predominantly African-American neighborhoods to blacks. They can't officially talk about the racial composition of neighborhoods, but they can, you know, surreptitiously, quietly, on the side, without notice, make assumptions about buyers' preferences, and then steer them to places, and as a result, perpetuating housing segregation by race. So all these are happening in the period from the 1940s, well into the end of the 20th century, and all of them are the subject of challenge by civil rights activists. But they face, again, as I say, the hurdles are high. Likewise, workplace discrimination. Detroit's got an amazing history of grassroots struggles against discrimination in the workplace, and to some extent, they succeed. In the 1940s, the United Automobile Workers pushes to open up assembly line jobs, blue-collar jobs, to African-Americans migrating to the city, and push for anti-discrimination clauses in their contracts with the major auto companies, basically saying companies can't discriminate against workers on the basis of race. And the result is jobs open up in those firms for African-Americans, but still the gains are partial and incomplete. Large sectors of the economy are still pretty close to blacks through the 50s, 60s, 70s, like skilled work, which is well-paying and pretty secure. The construction industry, nearly completely closed to African-Americans, at least unionized construction jobs, almost completely closed to African-Americans until 1969 and 1970, when the federal government implements what becomes affirmative action and requires contractors to hire minority workers. So what you see, in other words, is a really creative battle taking to the streets, demanding non-discrimination, demanding civil rights. In Detroit, 1963, just a few months before the March on Washington, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. speaks to 100,000 people gathered pushing for civil rights in the Motor City. And he actually gives an early version of the speech that he would give at the March on Washington, punctuated by his refrain, "I Have a Dream," in Detroit in June of 1963, a reminder of the importance of the civil rights movement in Detroit and in the North, and its wider influence. But the battles, the battles were hard fought and often only partially won.
Well, what you've told us, and just opening up this subject for discussion, you've already established that the issue that we're looking at in the 21st century had a long and entrenched history in the city of Detroit that goes back all the way back to the 20s and 30s and beyond that until we come to today. It's always important to look at a subject in its particular environment, as you see. So when we are going to get into the meat of this discussion, it is important to understand the backdrop here, and it is quite illuminating the way you have laid it out. Whether you have an idea. You've talked about the race issues that are clear. If, in fact, a measurement of democracy is the degree to which people have access to strategic resources, and one of these would be employment. You've just talked about the fact that there was a tug of war over that, so we could argue that Detroit had not been a very democratic city for a very long time. You've talked about the inequities in housing, so Detroit had not been a very democratic city in that regard. What would you say is the definitive turn that Detroit made for the worse, even worse than those things that you had pointed out?
Well, I mean, I think, the really critical moment in the city's history was the 1950s, right? A period that we think of as being kind of boring and complacent and prosperous. That's a moment when Detroit saw the beginning of its massive hemorrhage of jobs and population. That's the moment when many of the racial conflicts in the city that were the subject of civil rights protests could have been addressed by public officials. And that's a moment when, to a great extent, they dropped the ball. So the city, continues to hemorrhage jobs. Its economic leaders disengage from civic life. And the city government more or less stands back and tries doesn't try much other than building new highways, which they believe are going to attract people downtown. Well, they didn't realize that highways go in two directions, and they could just easily propel people outward. They put money into what were called urban renewal programs, many at the time called it Negro removal, referring to the fact that most of the neighborhoods that were slated for these projects were predominantly black neighborhoods, and often thriving business districts and residential areas were bulldozed away for the construction of projects that ended up not benefiting much of the population. And the assumption then, and really an assumption of a lot of urban development thereafter, is that somehow the benefits of these large-scale urban redevelopment projects will trickle down to the city's working class and precarious populations, lifting them up. And that, for the most part, didn't prove to be the case. So I think that's the critical moment, that period, you know, between World War II and the mid-1960s, or what we could broadly call the 1950s.
But during that time, wasn't Detroit actually marketed as a center, an ideal center of commerce? The automobile industry was doing very well, and there were jobs galore, and therefore a quality of life commensurate with that.
Definitely, but the question that Detroit started to struggle with and face in that period, the city in particular, was that jobs and people were moving to the suburbs, and for the most part, the poorer residents of the city, disproportionately minorities, couldn't go there. Public transportation connections didn't exist. Housing segregation kept them out. And so what you see is the metropolitan area in Detroit is thriving. It's continuing to grow in this period. Detroit has some of the richest suburban communities in the United States then and now, for that matter. Inhabited by auto execs and folks who work in the various white-collar industries that support the auto industry. But again, it's a matter of who benefits from the economic resources and the power in metropolitan Detroit. And the beneficiaries were less and less people who lived within the boundaries of the city itself. And less and less minorities.
Professor Segrou, could you give us a kind of summary, if you were imagining that you were writing a textbook or a course on studying Detroit in modern times, given the presentation that you helped us with today, to frame our point of reference before we get in deeply into a discussion about Detroit and the current crisis of Detroit, how would you give us, what would an overview be?
Well, that overview, I guess picking up where I left off in that discussion of the 50s and 60s, was that by 1970, Detroit is close to being a majority black city. And in that period, the white population withdraws from the public schools, which are, even when the city's not a majority black city, the public schools are already majority African American by 1960. And essentially whites withdraw from the public school system and believe that the responsibility for public education is not theirs anymore. There's a series of referenda in Detroit to increase the millage, that is the amount that you pay in property taxes to support the schools, and they're struck down again and again by a majority of white voters who say, not my schools, not my problem, I don't want to be spending my money there. And of course, as more and more people begin to move to the suburbs, folks living across the city line quickly adopt an us versus them mentality. We don't want our tax dollars going to them, that is, people living on the other side of the lines that divide city and suburb. And so what you see is an intensification of these hard and fast boundaries that separate city and suburb, that separate people with means from people without, that separate school districts and in America, to a great extent, in this period, where you live determines your quality of municipal services, your social services, your infrastructure, your public education especially, and how much you pay for it in the form of taxes. And those burdens start to be distributed really, really unevenly. So during the 70s and 80s, Detroit city governments are doing what city halls are doing all around the country. They're losing population and jobs, and they're saying, we've got to do something to bring them back. And so they go for glitzy downtown redevelopment projects. In Detroit, it's the Renaissance Center, high-rise towers along the city's waterfront that have offices and shopping and hotels originally. The city puts money into trying to attract some auto companies back into the city to build new factories there. And the successes on these are pretty small. I mean, the Renaissance Center is essentially like a fortress cut off from the rest of the city, and it doesn't serve as the generator of a lot of economic revitalization downtown like its promoters had intended. And the two auto factories that get built in this period, one of them replaces a plant that at its peak had employed about 35,000 workers, and then it employed a few thousand at best. So we're looking at efforts that are too small and too late in many respects to stem the tide of the problems facing the city. There's one bright light on the horizon, and that is every big city in the country, but especially the old industrial cities of the Northeast and Midwest, Detroit, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, and so forth, rely increasingly on three sectors of the economy to create new jobs. What we call meds and eds, medicine and higher education, universities, and public employment, government employment. And, if you think about who the biggest private employers are in almost every big city in the country, including Detroit, they're hospitals, medical centers, they're big public or sometimes private universities, and they are municipal and federal government and contractors working for the federal government. So in Detroit now, four of the five largest employers in the city are, the government and hospitals. So we're looking at a really significant shift in the economic base of the city. One of the big differences between Detroit and, say, Boston or Philadelphia, both of which, are facing a lot of the same problems that Detroit is facing in the 1970s and in 1980s, is that they've got a lot of colleges and universities and a lot of major medical centers. Detroit has two big medical centers, and it's got one major university, Wayne State, and that's pretty much it. And so those jobs are really important for Detroit's economy, but they're not enough. Detroit doesn't have, like Philadelphia, Temple University, University of Pennsylvania, Drexel University, Jefferson Medical College, on and on, that provide tens of thousands of jobs. But still, I mean, it's without those jobs, without those public sector jobs and those medical jobs and those higher education jobs, Detroit would have really gone into the tank. And those jobs especially are important for creating a fragile but growing black middle class in the period from the 1960s on forward. So that's the bright part of the story, even if it's not as bright in Detroit as it is in Boston or New York or Philadelphia or some other big cities in the United States in the same period.
I want to thank you so much for being the person to give us a kind of anchor in introducing Detroit to us from a historical perspective, but also giving us a comprehensive view about all the moving parts of this puzzle that will come to play certainly by October when the trial is heard, if there is one, as to the hearing, I should say, whether Detroit legally qualifies to declare bankruptcy. But either way, it is a really important subject to take a look at. And of course, you are our adopted guide in this discussion all the way through. So thank you so much for making yourself available to us, and certainly through your work that we get to know so much about the context that we need to consider as we discuss the city of Detroit.
Thank you
so much. All right, we will take this break and come back to you and your thoughts right after this, hearing some really good things about programs right here on PRN.FM. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lee. The number is 888-874-4888. what I wanted to do was get you to, we want to emphasize certain points and to get you to appreciate how you look at this issue. It's a modern day issue. It has a here and now kind of effect when we hear about Detroit and its bankruptcy issues and the fact that the city has literally gone into the tank and they're finger pointing all over the place. But the point is that the particular kind of problem that afflicts Detroit is not at all atypical. It is a problem that we've seen all across America, and perhaps this is a great time to get its, you know, a kind of clinical look at it. I'm sure it might have surprised you to hear that the civil rights struggle, quote unquote, in Detroit began a long time ago, that in fact the city that became known, you know, for the industry, the automobile industry, and a boom town, and the whole notion of prosperity, American prosperity, it in fact produced the one product that Americans are known for more than perhaps guns is cars, guns and cars. Okay, they produced the cars, but what Professor Sugru was telling us was that here was an opportunity, and it prevailed for a long time in the 20th century into the 21st century. That's a long time. That's several generations. And he's telling us that the notion of prosperity, in effect, was not meant to be shared democratically. The city was not meant to be hospitable to everyone. Democracy was not meant to thrive for everybody. And when people want to look at why situations develop the way they do, how it is that we have these racial striations, we have them not because people opt, not just because people opt to exercise their own prejudices, but because these prejudices are really organized by government and enforced by government, legislated, enforced by government. The establishment of an apartheid system in a big city where common sense would say, if in fact everybody thrived, the city would thrive. But the city had a history of deprivation of rights to certain people. For what reason? And is it not inevitable that after decades and decades and decades of these kinds of practices, the city of Detroit, like any other major city, would end up exactly where it is today? And as a result of serious deprivations being experienced by particular groups of people, entirely race-based. Detroit is presented to us as an economic or fiscal issue. Here's a government, a wrong-headed government with incapable people just running the city into the ground. Well, there is no question that you ought to question the capacity of people to lead and all of that. That has always been a case. But we look at the structure that was set up and maintained at least close to 60, going on to 100 years ago. What else do you expect? So what did you find fascinating today? What was an eye-opener for you from Dr. Sugru's introduction to the city of Detroit? 888-874-4888. I'd like to know what struck you as completely new. Now, this is not going to be the end of the discussion. We are going to come back to the discussion on Detroit quite frequently. especially since, as I said, October the 23rd is the day that these hearings would be held to determine whether Detroit qualifies to declare bankruptcy. But it is just either way, whichever way it goes, it is worth discussing as emblematic of where many cities are today. The same dynamic that Professor Segrou pointed out exists in every single one of the major cities that we are considering across the United States today. The same dynamic. Therefore, it tells you that there's a formula to it. This is not accidental stuff. This is according to formula. It's very important when you are discussing an issue to get the context of the issue. And the context is how this became a major city. What shaped it? Who shaped it? And why? What was the overarching objective? And how did it trickle down, for lack of a better term? How did the cities become so stratified? If, in fact, opportunity existed, if, in fact, we live in a society that preaches all the time, you know, hard work will get you where you want to go, that this is a land of the free, the home of the brave, and all of that, and we all have a wonderful nation that is eminently fair, and that everybody, if you put your nose to the grindstone, you reap in proportion to what you sow. But we're hearing a very different story. And this is from a person who is specialized in studying the formation of modern cities. And Detroit now comes to our attention in a very different way. It comes to us, to too many of us, in a very familiar way. And that way is the issue of racial oppression. That the goods and services of a city were not to be democratically enjoyed. That the promise of progress was not to be democratically enjoyed. And that the whole question of what is to be your quality of life, who shapes how you live, what you do, that was not to be a democratic exercise either. So I'm glad that we got this introduction today so that it would serve as our ongoing point of reference the deeper we get into the discussion about Detroit and its fiscal crisis. This brings us to the end of the program. I'm thankful that you joined me today. And tomorrow, we will have our open forum, so you can express your ideas as freely as you wish tomorrow. All right, until then, thank you so much for joining me, and let's see each other tomorrow again at 1 p.m. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Economic Update with Richard Wolff.